My name is Rich Anderson, and our topic is victims and perpetrators. And I guess what I'd like to talk with you some about today, and then give us all a chance to discuss the topic, is some information that over the last couple of years, I guess gleaned and learned from some readings and some workshops and doing some counseling and therapy with people that have been involved in some form of violence, most of the time within a family. And so most of the work that I've been doing has been with family violence situations, and often they've been physical or sexual abuse circumstances of parents to children or adults to adults. I've got a bad cold, I'm just getting over it. So. And what I want to do is try to present to you some information to try and understand a little bit of the dynamics that goes on in a abusive kind of relationship. And much of what I think I'll present will probably be on the perspective of what happens between two adults that are probably involved in a physically violent relationship. But I think that we can generalize a lot of what we're talking about to many other situations and circumstances in life, and we'll try to do a little of that at the end. I'll try and do some of that along the way too. To start out with, this continuum that I put up here is how we try to sort out and understand the difference between victims and perpetrators. On this end, of course, we have the victim, or the VV profile. On this end, we have the perpetrator-victim profile. And somewhere in the middle, it's identifiable also that there are some people who are victim-perpetrators. And I'll go on to explain all of them. That's this one. Primarily, and I've got a bunch of general information kind of about each group, starting out with this victim end of things, usually we find that individuals who are victims of abuse, sexual, physical, emotional, when they're adults, most often were victims when they were children. In other words, the experience of being a victim in many, many cases starts out when they're a child. There is a victimizing experience of some sort happens to them. And that doesn't always have to be being the brunt of some physical or sexual violence from an adult. There are adult victim personality types who, in looking back and trying to understand what the most victimizing experience was for them when they were a child, all they can really come up with was something such as mom and dad got divorced when I was 3. And so in trying to understand victimization, we need to really broaden our understanding of the options and the kinds of things that can happen to people to victimize them. And for a 3-year-old to lose one of their parents can be a very emotionally painful victimizing experience. And as a result of something like that, that individual might continue on through life developing maybe that kind of a profile. Okay. Some of the characteristics that we find in this victim profile are what we call pathological passivity. Many victims are pathologically passive. By that we mean that they'll lay down and be the doormat and let people walk over them and take advantage of them and put them down and just take it all. They seem to never stand up for themselves. Have a general sense of low self-esteem. Most of them are what we call pathologically low self-esteem. They feel worthless, they feel no good. They believe that about themselves. They set themselves up to fail. They do a lot of things to perpetuate the belief that they are worthless and no good. things such as getting involved in perfectionism, expecting themselves to be able to do things perfect. How many of us have succeeded at that? It's a guaranteed failure, isn't it? You expect yourself to do something perfect. You can't do it perfectly, but you try. And when you fail, you say, see, that just proves I'm no good. We also have what we call an external locus of control. Does anybody know what that is? Anybody understand locus of control and what that's all about?
This means place, doesn't it? Locus?
Yeah.
You mean to dominate it?
Now, a locus of control is essentially where you understand the control over decisions and thoughts and reactions and behaviors take place in your life. And usually you have an external locus or you have an internal locus. A victim-victim profile has an external locus of control. Other people tell me who I am. Other people make decisions for me. Other people know better than I am, and I have to ask them for direction or decisions. Other people's reactions to me are the most valid evaluation of who I am. And so their locus of control or their place by which they have decisions made about who they are as a person, decisions made about what they will do, how their life will function is essentially outside of them. They're the kind of people who will really never make a decision themselves. They can never commit them to anything. They'll never decide, oh, what do you think? You know, they're people pleasers. Whatever anybody else wants, they'll do that first. Okay. They also suffer with what we call lethal shame. Shame is a very interesting concept that's arisen in the last few years. And victims have a shame bone in their body that's almost enough to kill them. They shame themselves. Every time they don't succeed at something or they set themselves up to fail, then they shame all over themselves. Strong sense of moralizing directed towards being bad and being a bad, wretched, awful person.
Is this the same thing as guilt, or would you differentiate that from guilt?
Yeah, it's different than guilt, because they can shame themselves for things that they aren't even guilty of. For example, they may go up to the coffee urn after supper tonight, pour themselves a cup of regular coffee, and walking back, shame themselves over not choosing decaffeinated because I think for some reason decaf is better than caffeinated. There's no guilt involved in that necessarily, but they'll shame themselves for it. Okay. There's also a real struggle in this profile for differentiation. Victims that are victim-victim profiles don't know where the clear boundaries are between who is me and who is my family and who are my friends and where do I belong. And they have a real hard time, especially in their family, of knowing who is me and who is mom and who is dad. There's no clear separation between I am different, I am not like you. It's all wrapped up in I'm just like you, I'm here to please you, whatever you say, please tell me how to live, all that kind of thing. It's all mixed in a big mess. You can't separate it out. And many of them that really, really have lots of trouble with it don't know the difference between themselves and other family members. They have no clear, separate identity. Psychological diagnoses are usually narcissistic or passive-dependent personalities. And they usually either have a very, very rigid loyalty to their family, or it's total rejection. So it's very interesting. There's a lot of what we call all or nothing thinking. Either they stick with their family no matter how nice or how bad they are, or they totally reject them all, have nothing to do with them. They'll also do the all or nothing thinking kind of thing. It's either got to be this way or it's worthless. I've either got to succeed 100% perfectly or I've failed. There's a lot of that kind of struggle. There's a lot of that perception stuff. These kind of personalities also have multiple failures. Of course, if we understand the low self-esteem stuff, all the shame stuff, all the setting themselves up to fail kinds of things that they do, they basically fail one time after another, after another, after another. Many of them failed in school, they failed at jobs, they failed at relationships, lots of times. Many of the adult victims that we've seen in domestic abuse treatment are third or fourth marriage relationships. They've had multiple divorces. They've had multiple occupations. They've changed from this to this to this to this. Failures, many, many kinds of things, no matter which way they turn. These people also have a couple other things going for them. I don't know if going for them is the right term. One of them is that they have an inability to have fun. They don't know how to enjoy themselves. They don't know how to let go and just play. Everything is serious. Everything has got to be work, work, work. Nothing can be screwing around and enjoying themselves. And I don't know if any of you know people that are somewhat like this or behave this kind of way, but many times the inability to have fun and just let go and be silly or goofy or childish is a real indicator that we notice that for some reason something's gone awry back there. They've experienced some sense of victimization back in the past. Okay, there's also a sense of powerlessness, no control. This kind of a personality feels like they have no control over their life, no control over the world. They have no power, they have no say, and they basically have to accept whatever gets handed to them. They also are caught in what we see as a paradox. The victim-victim kinds of profiles are forced as children, as a result of their victimization, to mature very early. They become adults at age 7 or 8 or 10. They lose their childhood. So developmentally, as adults, physically now, they're still children. They've never been able to pass through and work through whatever kinds of years they lost. And so here they are in an adult body, and they're still developmentally or emotionally a child, and they lost that back then, or they were never able to do it. They never had the opportunity. We also see patterns of self-abusive behavior. Many of the victim-victim kinds of people are caught up in re-victimization. They no longer need some other person to abuse them or to make them the victim. They'll self-abuse. And so there's a lot of chemical dependency things happening with these people. There's an awful lot of sexual abuse, physical abuse. There's a lot of self-maiming. One of the things that we look for in adolescent chemical dependency treatment is tattoos and physical disfigurement. And in adolescents who come through for chemical dependency treatment, which is already a cycle of self-abuse and addiction, with those with tattoos, much of the recent punk kinds of stuff of the physical disfiguring of themselves, the carving of their skin and the bodies and that kind of stuff, almost 100% leads to the fact that back there they were sexual or physical abuse victims. And so we look at that kind of stuff when we have an adolescent coming through treatment and immediately red flag that and expect eventually, as the treatment process goes along, for that kind of historical information to come out. And it almost always does. Okay. The kinds of self-victimization things also that happen are a lot of psychosomatic complaints, lots of chronic ongoing illnesses. They believe that they're worthless, no good, that they deserve to be victimized, and they continue to stay sick as a form of re-victimizing themselves. And a lot of the eating disorder issues are also caught up in this. There's a lot of anorexia, a lot of bulimia that we see with victim-victim profiles. Again, another form of self-victimization. I want to eat, I don't deserve to be overweight. I want to eat, I don't deserve the food. So they go throw up. Let's see, what else is there? There's also a real strong tendency to personalize lots of things that have nothing to do with them as a person. So somebody may say something or something may happen and they'll think it's their fault, or they'll think, well, if I would have been there and done this instead, I could have prevented it. There's a great tendency to be codependent. Next week I'm going to talk about codependency as it relates in a alcoholic or chemical dependency relationship. But a lot of these people are very, very codependent in the sense that they devote their whole lives to trying to focus on somebody else and take care of somebody else who is going to be in some form dependent on them. And of course that becomes the external locus kind of issue that we talked about too. Let's see. Okay, maybe that's first place to stop and see if you have any questions. Anything about, sure.
You're talking about physical and sexual abuse. Does emotional abuse also, is that also considered, when you were saying, like, the kids that have hurt themselves and those things, you see that as a sign of, if they've been a victim, you consider that also possibly a sign of just the emotional abuse?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. There's some adolescents that we've seen where you dig and probe and dig and probe, and no matter what, even the kids in total cooperation trying to find out and look at what's going on, come up with absolutely no sexual or physical abuse. But when they start describing their relationship to a stepfather, he basically ignored them or literally screamed at them. And their experience of losing their father, who maybe was a very close, warm, nurturing parent through a divorce, and getting a stepfather who basically saw the kid as totally in my way and get out of my life, was an emotionally abusive, victimizing experience for them. And that can set an individual up to develop this whole kind of profile all the way on through life.
Is it possible for any of these conditions to be genetic? Can you say a father pass it on to a child, or the tendency being passed on without any?
It's sort of like which came first, the chicken or the egg.
Yeah.
We don't know. I don't think we know much of anything about the genetic basis for behavior or personality. And it's very, very difficult to separate out learned behavior from an environment and try and say, well, that wasn't something they learned, they must have inherited it, right? I guess, it's from everything I've read, No one's ever dug into that. Any other questions about this end of the continuum?
Could you speak just a little bit to the word? To me, victim is something that almost a force that's coming in from the outside, but you're using the term in the sense of, I mean, you could have twins, it seems like to me, in that case, where one of them would be, I mean, depends on how you perceive it. You know, how would they react to a divorce? I mean, if some children react very negatively to divorce, some of them seem to, you know, it's a bad situation, but they go on, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's true for all of life. I mean, everybody's background has some bad things that happen to it.
Right. Yeah. And everybody copes in different ways. And the adults that we deal with that end up really pretty much falling towards this end of the continuum are those who have coped in the past in a way that is developing this kind of a profile. And like you say, you could have identical twins who maybe, let's take the parents getting divorced. Both experience that as an emotionally traumatic experience. And one develops one way and one develops another. The problem with that is that genetically identical twins are never environmentally or relationally identical. And so one of those twins is going to be closer to one parent than the other. And their environments are always going to be different. And of course, like you say, the way they interpret experiences happening in life, they're going to see things differently. And one's going to see black and one's going to see white. And how you do anything about that, I'm not sure.
Wouldn't that be personality? What rate a person is, to go with the personality?
Sure. And identical twins, if anybody knows identical twins, you know that personality-wise, they're identical. Should we go on to the next one? Mm-hmm. Middle one? Well, let's jump on just for the fun of it to this end. And then we'll come back to the middle. The perpetrator-victim profile is also, because of the small v, an individual who's experienced some kind of victimization in the past, of some sort, whether it's physical, emotional, sexual, or just what. This individual has been victimized in some way, who knows. These are the kind of people that we call sociopathic deviants. These are the sort of people who, when we test them on Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory tests, are four nines. The 4-9 profile is a sociopath. It's the kind of person that basically really doesn't have any kind of guilt. They don't really have any kind of sense of conscience most of the time. Very self-oriented. They don't have any concern for other people. Denial is a massive defense mechanism that they use a lot. And these are the kind of people who generally inflict or perpetrate violence on other people. These are the ones who come home from work, didn't like the fact that it was hot and got stuck in a traffic jam on the way home. And so when he walks in the door and his wife doesn't have everything laid out the way he wants it, he picks her up and slams her against the wall. Gives her a black eye and tells her to get cooking. Walks in the other room, sits down, thinks nothing of it. Has no sense of remorse or guilt or whatever for doing that. Basically will deny to themselves when their rage and their anger goes that they even did that. And they may even have a teenage son or daughter walk up to them 5 minutes later and say, "Dad, why did you do that to Mom?" And he's like, "Do what?" And in a sense, their denial will be so strong that they will honestly believe they didn't do it. They'll have what we call as a sincere delusion. They don't think they do it. They also deny very strongly whatever this past victimization was. And so intensive, ongoing, long-term therapy with this individual almost never comes up with whatever victimization took place way back then. It's very, very difficult to get something out of their past.
How do you know it's there?
Often you can get it from other family members, history gathering from aunts and uncles or from siblings or even parents. And you do get it from some individuals, such that when you're dealing with this kind of an individual, you automatically suspect it. And if you don't find it, you still believe it's there. The rule of thumb is that you're better off assuming it happened than being naive and thinking it didn't. And when all the other pieces fall together on that kind of a personality profile, it's your best bet to assume it's there. Okay, these people perpetuate abuse in order to gain a sense of control. And to feel that they are powerful. Control and power are major issues in this individual's self-esteem and sense of identity and ego. And most of the time, they're overcompensation issues. Because these individuals will feel, if you're able to get them in a rare moment of honesty and openness, I mean rare. These individuals just basically will never let you inside. Occasionally when you do, you'll find out that they feel pathologically out of control and powerless. And that vulnerability to them is life-threatening. They actually believe that if they get out of control, if they admit to their powerlessness, they could die. And so going after control and power, especially over other people, is something that they almost need like their next breath of air to feel like they're going to be able to continue to survive. The sense of dominance, again, falls in there, control and power. They need to dominate the people that they're around. And so they dominate their spouses, they dominate their children, they run the show at home, they are autocratic. And much of the time, ways in which they inflict control and power over other people, if it's not through fear, it's through absolute physical or sexual kind of abuse. If somebody doesn't comply out of a threat, they'll beat them up. One individual that I worked with for quite a while, who kind of falls into this category, lived with a stepfather who was this way for 10 years. And the stepfather's way of controlling this kid when he was about 14 or 15, and to exercise his power over this kid, was to sneak up on the kid early in the morning while he was still sleeping, and grab his arms and tie his arms and his legs, drag him into the backyard, put him in a sack, and hang him up in the tree. And that kid hung in that sack in that tree for hours and hours and hours on end, and literally, just lapsed into unconscious for a while, until Dad came home from work and let him out. Once his mother let him down and let him out, and Dad literally just about killed her by beating her up. That perpetrator had such a strong need for power and control that he'd do that. Now this kid, in his struggle for victimization, was ready to go shoot the guy. He didn't care if he went to prison. Now, what's the problem with killing somebody and going to prison over it? That's right. You're re-victimizing yourself to give away all of your freedom and the rest of your future in order to perpetuate vengeance. So it became just a re-victimizing experience for this kid. And once he saw, God, I'd love to see him dead, but I don't think I want to give up the rest of my life in order to get that.
How did he finally get out of that situation?
He ran away. He ran away, hitchhiked from Colorado to Minnesota, came to his real father's home, told his real father the truth about it all, hid out, all this kind of stuff, and his real father brought him in for therapy.
You're talking about this PV person in strictly male terms. I wonder, are there women that end up like this, and what are they like?
Well, there are women that end up like that. You're right. We don't know quite as much about them because they're much more closeted. It's much, and there are men who are like this, but they're also much more closeted. Because it's very, very difficult for a man to come out of the closet and say, I got to do something, I need help, my wife's beating me up every night. It just, you know, that just isn't very macho. And people look at him and say, you're living with a woman who's beating you up every night? What's wrong with you?
Yeah.
It's a real ego struggle to admit that to begin with. But there are a number of women that are like that and do that. And they really aren't much different than the men. They, again, they test out as 4.9s. They have much of the same kind of dynamics. Probably the only thing that we rarely ever see in them is sexual abuse of their spouse. There'll be a lot of physical abuse and a lot of emotional abuse. But they will be the ones who will sexually abuse their male children. Because, of course, there's a lot less fear of being caught with that. You can intimidate and you can frighten these children into being quiet and abuse them with much less chance that the child is going to turn you in for that than your husband. But then again, there's real little chance that a husband who keeps getting raped at home by his wife is going to turn her in either. But it happens. These people, these 4.9s, have no shame, no guilt, no concept that what they're doing is wrong or inappropriate. Their belief is that they have every right to do what they're doing and it's perfectly okay and acceptable. Basically, they want to hurt other people. They want to defend themselves from their past victim pain by having an aggressive defense. The best way to not continue to feel the pain of my victimization in the past is control, power, and to hurt before someone hurts me. So the best defense is a good offense. 90% of the men in Stillwater Prison in Minnesota have been sexually abused as children. And so what you're talking about is that these sociopathic personalities, which also often end up being imprisoned because of their behavior, 90% of those currently, or at least when the study was done, were sexually abused as children. And in the women's prison, when you talk about the women that fall in this category, 98% of them had been sexually abused as children. Okay, before I move here, any questions about the abuser?
maybe not the right question. Would Ted Bundy fall under that category? Or would he,
I don't know much about him. I don't know a whole lot about him. Tell everybody a little bit more about the way, who and what Ted Bundy was.
I'm sorry.
He just murdered lots of girls.
He was guy that's down in California, Florida that.
Yeah, he, how many, 7 or 8 or something?
Well, he's accounted a couple cases maybe in the state of Washington.
Also Colorado.
Colorado, and then finally got caught in Florida.
Basically, is he the guy that sexually abused them and murdered them?
Yeah.
Okay, certainly, I think he's way down here on that kind of thing. Because he went beyond the sexual abuse to murdering them. And there's a good chance that he was more than just a 4-9, he was probably a 4-8-9, he was probably a psychopathic personality. Whereas, and you know, in that sense, there's a lot of mental illness going on there. And there are those people also. I'm more talking about the people that aren't necessarily mentally ill, that aren't psychopathic, but that are what we call sociopathic. They do all these kinds of things, but appear perfectly normal, and they live right next door to you.
And they're actually
Ted Bundy, he had a perfect record.
They can learn, very intelligent.
Sure.
Lottery.
Yeah. There's a lot of psychopaths that are very intelligent, very, very successful. There's some people I know who believe they get elected as President of the United States occasionally.
That profile is known for being like leaders of gangs and mobs, and also being like successful businessmen, and it's a high energy level with his sociopathic personality, and it's a tough combination. If they're on your side, and you're a good quality.
Sure. If you know what we're talking about with a 4-9, the MMPI plots out a whole bunch of personality characteristics. And what it does is give you a graph like this. And when you read the two peaks, then there's some characteristics about this personality that you can gather from looking at the profile peaks. And a 4-9 has their fourth and their ninth profile elevated. And the fourth one is basically what we look at as being an anger profile. Most of the time, they're really angry if they got an elevated 4, and their energy level is up here at a 9. So they're a very angry, very high energy kind of individual that's out there acting out their anger in their behavior. Sometimes.
Then just a person with a good self-image could have the high 9, but not the high 4. I mean, a normal, self-motivated type of...
Sure. Yeah, that's very possible. I think people like Gaddafi probably psychopathic personalities in the area of the rule of the country. Sure, they'd have a spike. We're getting into MMPI now. No, they'd have a 6 spike. They'd probably have another 8 spike
for being
schizzy. Two personalities, you know. And their 6 spike is the up being very paranoid, mistrusting, and don't believe anybody else is worth telling anything secret about. Okay. That's a mini workshop on the moon, yeah. We weren't ever going to get into. Any more about the blatantly obvious perpetrator? Yeah.
Often it seems perpetrators are more violent than they drink.
Mm-hmm.
Are these people often chemical abusers, or does that just mask this more basic problem? I have a hard time differentiating when it's a chemical abuse problem and when it's actually a personality problem.
I would tend to say that when they're abusive, when they drink, it's both a chemical problem and an abuse problem. There's a lot of perpetrators who are totally this way and don't drink. Or when they're under the influence of chemicals, don't perpetuate any kind of abuse. But the ones you're talking about who become violent or abusive when they are drinking, I really don't think that it's worth the effort to separate which is which. Most of the time it's both. And what happens is that when they aren't under the influence of the chemical, they're able to exercise some kind of control and inhibit much of their urges and needs and that kind of thing. When they, you know, their inhibitions get loosened up when they're intoxicated, it just comes out and they let it fly. When we talk about alcoholism next week, we'll talk about how some of this kind of stuff that happens when you've been drinking is also some real diagnostic information for determining whether someone's chemically dependent or not. What we find too in chemical dependency treatment, at least in Minnesota, is when you start doing physical and sexual abuse profile evaluations, we're coming up with 70-some% of people going through chemical dependency are involved in a physical or sexually abusive relationship of some sort. And I don't know why this is happening, but we're finding many, many couples coming in for chemical dependency treatment and they've been physically violent of some sort in their marriage relationship. And I think part of that is because most of the time you've got one of these married to one of these, and he goes out and gets drunk and gets a ticket and gets court ordered to go through treatment, and then all of a sudden you start ferreting out lots of other stuff going on too.
You said with the victim, that one of the things you said was not capacity to play and to just kind of let themselves
go. Mm-hmm.
I often think of very rigid and people, potentially violent people, as being the same way. But is that true to the same extent?
Well, I think the perpetrators have that element of V from back here too. And so they have a lot of these victim kinds of characteristics. They've been victims in the past, and rather than remain victims and even set themselves up to continually be re-victimized, they've overcompensated with their aggressive defense. My guess is that they too have a difficult time having fun. Although, like we just talked, a lot of those people go out and get drunk, and that's their form of fun. They re-victimize themselves through their chemical abuse or addiction, and their sense of euphoric intoxication gives them some feeling that they're having a good time.
Well, classically, high four scale have trouble forming relationships. They can't get close to people.
Right.
They're thinking only of themselves and all that stuff.
Real difficulty with intimacy. And it's basically a fear of hurt and pain if I let somebody get close. We move on to this one? Okay. The middle one, the victim perpetrator profile, is a rather interesting one. And I think up until a couple years ago, before I started to study this and learn more about it and deal with people doing it, I had never thought that maybe this alternative existed. It was usually, there are people who get beat up or raped, and there are people who do it. Well, there are people that fall in the middle. These people were victimized when they're young, and they know that they were victimized, and they've most often lived the victim kind of experience for a long time. Maybe through their youthful years, their adolescent years, they continue to victimize themselves. They struggle with much of these same kind of characteristics that the victim have. The difficulty is, well, the generalization we can often make is that the victim perpetrators are victims, but at times they overreact and perpetrate violence. or maybe a good example to understand that is that if you've got a relationship of a husband who's a perpetrator and a wife who's a victim and gets beat up by her husband, what kinds of things do you see happen when she loses her temper with her children? She abuses her children. And so we may find a situation where we have a child who's been physically abused, and you go back into the family to find out what's going on and who's doing it, and mother's the one who's physically abused the child. And then when you do a complete family profile and assessment and haul dad in and get him involved also, you find out dad is beating up mom and mom is beating up the kids. And then you may find that dad's been beating up older sister or older brother, and older brother's been beating up littler brother. And in the family, then, you often have an obvious perpetrator victim. Lots of victims, some of whom choose to become perpetrators at times, but not all the time. Does that make sense? Let's see. I think what happens characteristically is that when some of these victims become victim perpetrators because of the same reason that this person becomes a perpetrator, and that is they're real uncomfortable and unhappy with their sense of powerlessness, with their sense of no control over life. And they may lash out and for a momentary experience become a perpetrator to try to gain some more control, to try and gain some sense of power in their situation. And I think it's really easy to understand when you have a wife who's a victim and feels totally worthless, no good, powerless, and out of control, and all of a sudden she can't even get her children to mind her. And she may react by nailing the kid alongside the head to attempt to get some sense of control and power over that child at least. I've got to at least be able to control somebody in this world. I can't control me or my husband, and now I can't even do it with my kids. Let's see. Okay, these are the people, and it's very interesting, who often want to get caught. These are the people who may turn themselves in, or they may do something that obviously is a cry for help. They may be perpetuating some abuse, and they may tell somebody who then turns them in, and then they'll get some help. And these are the people that are abuse perpetrators that we love to be able to get and work with, because they do feel guilty, and they feel lots of shame, and they feel lots of remorse. Many times, the victim perpetrator profile is what we'll find in a father who maybe only in a few isolated incidences has been physically or sexually abusive of a child and feels lots of shame and guilt about it, feels enough powerlessness and out of control in his life that he doesn't know how to stop it, that he doesn't know what to do to correct things, and will at some point drop some hints or raise some red flags and get himself some help or get the family some help, so that then some outside force, again, some external locus, will intervene and break the whole chain and make it quit. This kind of a profile doesn't want to be an abuser. They also don't want to be a victim. They also have no sense of power or control to know what to do. Feel really caught up in a fast-moving stream and they don't know how to get out. interesting kind of thing is that they're perpetuating abuse as a form of self-victimizing themselves. That when you're a victim, and nobody's victimized you lately, one of the things you can do is go beat up your kid and then feel lots of shame and remorse and guilt for what a terrible, rotten, awful person you are for beating up your kid. And then keep your whole sense of re-victimization going. It seems real crazy to think that somebody who has been a victim and isn't getting victimized enough will go out and perpetuate abuse on somebody else in order to continue their re-victimization cycle. They'll do that. The sense of shame and guilt is painful, but it's deserved. And sometimes it's even needed. And so they'll inflict it in order to get the degrading, worthless self-esteem perspective reinforced and the shame and the guilt dumped back on again, heavier. They'll also do things like perpetrating victim violence or abuse of some sort becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Everybody know what a self-fulfilling prophecy is? You believe something's going to happen and then it does because you go about making sure that it will. They believe their life is out of control. They believe they're a worthless, no good person. And then they may just cattle prod or taunt one of the kids into an argument and then hit them. In order to fulfill the belief that they have, that they are, you know, an awful, terrible, worthless, no good person. There's an awful lot of pain, an awful lot of anger going on, and much of this moving into a perpetrator perspective or role for a while becomes another way of acting out that kind of emotion. The other day when we talked about what do you do with anger, one of the things that happens in a lot of people that stuff their anger or their emotions is that it gets acted out in their behavior. And sometimes they're not even conscious of the fact that they're acting it out in their behavior. But I think all of us know different people who just generally sort of seem kind of angry or bitter or negative or hostile much of the time. And that's kind of a red flag as to the fact that maybe they've got a lot of residual anger or bitterness or resentment down inside, and it just kind of comes out, dribbles out, spills out every once in a while. And sometimes it can come out in their behavior. They're just blowing up and hitting somebody. And who knows where it came from. Okay. This sort of thing happens often on a two-way street. And many times, well, like I drew a continuum out here because you very rarely find totally one of these or totally one of these. Usually a person is moving back and forth along the continuum to different degrees. And this person has been a victim and will re-victimize themselves again at times. This person moves back and forth either direction. This person can move back and forth into many of those different kinds of roles too. What's very interesting about this individual is that they're very treatable and really, really sincerely deep down wanting to get help. This individual, absolutely no concept that they did anything wrong or need any help or want it. And as a matter of fact, everybody else is a total jerk and crazy to think that they did anything wrong or deserve to be arrested or deserve to be treated or need to see a shrink of any sort. So it's very, very interesting when you, after a while, when you get the perpetrator coming into the office in about 2-3 minutes, immediately know whether you've got one of these or you've got one of those. And after a while, when you deal with enough victims, it becomes very obvious a lot of times that their re-victimization indicates their general kind of victim profile mindset that they're continuing to perpetuate. Okay, questions? Comments?
What do you think about it? Now that you figured all this out, you know you got one of those. That's a whole other subject.
Well, there are some very sophisticated and structured treatment programs that involve individual and couple and family therapy on a fairly extensive basis that people have to go through in order to immediately intervene and make things stop. Often, some sort of living apart has to happen, some getting away from perpetrators, getting away from victims, and separating that out and not living within the same environment for a while in order to stop the actual physical things going on. And quite a bit of ongoing group and individual therapy has to be done.
It seems to me that, as you were listing the different characteristics, I was trying to think now, where would I have tendencies to be? And it's clear to me that I've not perpetrated overt violence towards people and haven't been in that kind of relationship. But it seems to me that most people have some experiences of being a victim, or perhaps to some extent of being a perpetrator, at least of emotional violence. Mm-hmm. So that spectrum, that little line, seems to be part of a bigger line. In other words, or would be a particular case of some more overt acting out of what a lot of us go through and struggle with in terms of being a victim. Or
sure. And I think, like he brought up earlier, many people can experience a victimizing kind of experience in their life and not necessarily develop into a victim kind of profile, but will adapt and cope with that in a different way. The identical twins, both of whom maybe lose a parent in a divorce, or both of whom were sexually abused by the same parent, or physically abused by a parent, don't necessarily have to grow up and develop this kind of a profile. They don't necessarily have to grow up and become perpetrators. Some will and some won't. Why some do and why some don't, it's real difficult to figure that one out. Much of it depends on the ongoing environment that they continue to grow and develop in. And I think, I tend to believe that those of us, that everybody experiences victimizations of some sort at some part in their life. And some of the real obvious ones are, when you're 13 and you fall in love and then he or she dumps you. And the fact that you're just about to die because of the broken heart experience really is an emotional victimization experience that's very painful. But the fact that you're living maybe in a supportive environment, that you've got close friends, that you've learned to be able to be open and share intimate thoughts or feelings with, that you've got family that you feel you can tell about this and get a lot of help and support from, is the best way to survive that and not develop into a victim and go out and get more of it. And so I think a lot of us are able to cope and live through victimizing kinds of experiences because of the fact that we learn lots of skills and talents and abilities and have support and have intimate relationships that are real helpful for us. A lot of people don't have those. And when they're victimized, they've got nothing. They've got no learned abilities and they've got no support group. And they continue to go on and develop some of these kinds of profiles. I just heard the dinner bell. How about it?
Okay.
you come up here and I'll talk to you about it alone.
My question was just, what do we as Christians, lay people, Christians do?
I think we do the best we can to be that kind of close personal support group to people that we know need help, need somebody who cares about them.